And welcome to Rusted Junk, the 80s movie podcast. Do you dream about gremlins? How hard can you actually die? Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe? If those mean something to you, then you're in the right place. This season, we're all about a dip into the 90s. So over to Charlie, Amanda, Joe and Dom for the film.
So, no Amanda for this one, unfortunately, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm very excited. We're covering Unforgiven. Unforgiven, a 1992 American Western film produced and directed by Clint Eastwood. Stars Eastwood himself as William Money, an aging outlaw and killer who takes on one last job after he turned to farming. The film co-stars Gene Hackman, Morgan Freeman, Richard Harris. Set in the late 1800s, it delves into themes of redemption, violence, the blurred lines between heroism and villainy. Money's mission leads him to confront his past and question the very nature of justice in a brutal and unforgettable story. It had a US gross of $101 million and an international gross of $58 million. Bad for a Western. So a worldwide total of $159 million. Metacritics gave it 85 with the Metacritic user score 8.9 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, 96% critic score and 95% users. I mean, it's ridiculous. So such outstanding scores for that. But anyway, let's go into the trailer. I'll see you on the other side.
Step over to the office and get the bullwhip.
A whipping? That's all they get after what they've done?
Get out of there!
It was a matter of honor.
They're paying $1,000 to whatever kills the two boys that cut up Delilah.
In a time when lawmen were killers.
What are y'all looking at?
You English, Bob?
Outlaws were heroes.
Well, I thought that you were dead.
Hell, I even thought I was dead. Till I found out it was just in Nebraska.
And a bad reputation.
You're the one who killed William Harvey and robbed that train over Missouri?
Was as good as gold.
My guess is you're calling yourself Mr. William Money.
Say what?
You don't look no meaner than hell, cold-blooded damn killer.
I ain't like that anymore, kid.
$1,000 reward, Will.
Nobody's gonna come.
So you still have that Spencer rifle, huh?
Yeah. He's my partner. If he don't go, I don't go.
What's it come to, three ways?
Just because we're going on this killing, that don't mean I'm gonna go back to being the way I was.
Are you really gonna kill them cowboys?
I do not like assassins. Or men of low character.
We ain't bad men no more. We're farmers.
Savages! A bunch of bloody savages!
Assassin! Well, I guess they have it coming.
We all have it coming, kid.
Some legends will never be forgotten. Some wrongs can never be forgiven.
The man don't want to get killed. Better clear on out the back.
Unforgiven.
So I don't think that trailer gives much away, really. I think it entices you in. And you reckon?
I think it makes it look like a more linear film than it actually is. You know, that looks a bit more like a traditional film. Clint Eastwood takes his time as he directs this film that we're about to discuss and review. So, but perhaps that's the limitations of a trailer. It's just this, then this, then this, then this. But yeah, not that representative of the film, I didn't think.
Absolutely.
I think the trailer basically shows this is a Clint Eastwood Western, and then I think that's what they tried to sell, and that's what a lot of people want to see, and that's good enough for me. You know, I mean, I remember when I saw the trailer, it's like, all right, this looks pretty good. Regardless of what the story is all about, I'm sold.
So it is your film, Joe. So I've got to say, man, I know there's no nice way to say it. So why did you pick it? Why did you choose it?
So it's interesting. I was going to pick something else. But I happened to speaking to my nephew, and we were talking about Westerns, and he said he was never a fan of Westerns. And I told him, I said, I'll be honest with you, that there's, for me, in my book, there's only a few really good Westerns. And I was a big fan of Clint Eastwood's spaghetti Westerns, the Dollars trilogy. I told him, I says, you should check those out. I think you would like that, because on my show, Nerd Alert, we talk about comic books. And that character is the inspiration of so many comic book characters. because he's just so different from your typical Western hero. He's like they might even turn the phrase anti-hero after him, because he's not necessarily good, he's not necessarily bad, you know, but
is he ugly, Joe?
What's that?
I had to get that in. Is he ugly?
Is he ugly? At times he could be ugly, I would say. Right. So I suggested, I says, if you get a chance, just watch one of those movies. If you don't like it, you know, watch for 10 minutes and then just turn it off. But then I thought about, like, since we're doing the 1990s, Unforgiven, which was, in my book, one of the last great Westerns. And I don't know if most people feel that way, but I do. I can't really recall a Western that occurred after that really sold me. There's been a few, you know, Kevin Costner, and there have been
Tombstone.
Tombstone? I mean, I like Tombstone, but Tombstone is less of a movie and more of an action movie for me. I thought, I don't know. Like,
what about the epicness of White Earp then? I mean, I know I'm biased because
of White Earp. Oh yeah, I watched a little bit of that. I couldn't finish it. I don't know. I just couldn't get into it. I do like Tombstone for the action. I do like Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday. I think he sort of won, or at least be, I don't know if he was nominated for an Oscar for that role, but I think it's an amazing role. But he's also surrounded by mediocre writing and not the greatest acting in the world either. So yeah, that's not the last great Western in my book. This one is. And
Right Back Mountain Joe?
Oof. No, I never seen that one. So
you don't see that.
That's debatable. Why did you guys see that?
I've seen it.
Sometimes at night when I'm in a certain sort of mood, put it on that old friend and just
on your silk sheets.
Takes me around to that smell of the campfire and the beans.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking something completely different. Sorry.
You know, and a man's mind turns to these things. So yeah, just for me, it's just a piece of comfort watching, really, I think. Not for you two, though, no?
Well, no, it's not. Wait a minute, before any accusations, I just haven't got around to seeing it.
Oh, okay, interesting. Curious. Neither of you have seen it. Okay.
No, I know the storyline. I don't think I'm very interested in that storyline, to be honest with you. I don't know if I would call that a Western. And more of a love story. But getting back to this movie, I do like Clint Eastwood. I don't think he's a great actor. I've always said this. I think he's a great presence.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Less is more with him. Like when he only says a few things, but when he says it, he makes to mean it. And again, he just does more by looking than most people do by talking. And in this movie, again, I think he plays a good role because he's different. I guess we'll get into the movie, but I just think I really love it. And what I really like, again, because like I'm a comic book guy, is that they based the story Old Man Logan, which is about Wolverine, on this movie. And I know, like, when they filmed Logan with Hugh Jackman, the director had told his crew to watch this movie before they filmed. And it's very similar, where like Wolverine, the character, did something horrible in his past, and he's now an older man, and he refused to pop his claws. He refused to fight. You know, he became a farmer, and he had a family. And you know, it's not the same as the Logan movie. You know, it's different. But he has to go on this road trip in order to, you know, get a certain amount of money to basically pay the mafia in this kind of like Old West or New West, which was the Hulk family. They're a bunch of bad guys, but it ends up, they end up doing him dirty. And at the very end, he pops his claws for the first time, and then he becomes the old Wolverine that he was. And I guess like when I watch this movie, and I kind of go back and forth. I kind of think of the comic, and when I read the comic, I think of the movie. Anyway, I think it's a really good movie. I think it's a good movie to talk about since it's a 90s movie that we're doing. But yeah, And I will say, I will give this a 9 out of 10. That's my score.
Excellent. I always go first or last. Can I go in the middle, Doc? Is that all right?
Mate, you can be the meat in this particular sandwich.
Well, so, thank you. Yeah, how kind.
Continue to my Brokeback Mountain analogy, but yeah, you go for it.
I did have my bag of cinema tickets and left it, but one of them would be Unforgiven, the stub for Unforgiven when I saw it in 1992. I didn't know what to expect. I kind of like Gene Hackman. I was kind of like a big fan of Gene Hackman, so I kind of went, unlike you, Joe, the Hunter household never really grew up on Westerns. It wasn't really a thing. But Clint Eastwood most definitely was. Dad's favourite. Dirty Harry, you know, all the stuff that we'll get into in Roll Call. And, yeah, so I was pretty much just looking forward to watching this. It had all the Oscar buzz. It had all of that sort of stuff. And my goodness, when I sat down to watch it this last week, it brought back memories of sitting in the cinema for the first time and just being utterly captivated, mesmerized by the film. I mean, I can't think of another word to think of it. It's just, there are things wrong with it, which we'll get to, but my goodness, acting masterclass.
Yeah.
Right here. It's right here. Look no further. Where do you want to turn? You're right about Clint Eastwood being a presence rather than an actor. Gene Hackman, however, is both a presence and an actor. Morgan Freeman, dedicated actor. Richard Harris, dedicated actor. You know, don't want to put them into particular buckets or, you know, or roles. I mean, we'll get into that. But my goodness, I just sat there. You couldn't tear yourself away from it. Amanda watched part of it, so she hasn't seen the last 45 minutes because, unfortunately, she couldn't see the last 45 minutes, but yeah, wow. So for me, I'm staying with the critics. I'm staying with you, Joe. There are tiny things wrong with it. That just gives me enough that I can't give it a 10, but I'm going to give it a 9. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. So, Dom, are you joining the 9 party, or where are you going?
Well, I'm not sure we've reviewed a film like this before, have we, on the pod? A directorial masterpiece like this, so heavily Oscar-nominated. And I personally found this the hardest film to review and score of any we've done on this pod. So the first thing to say is, unlike last week on Blade, when I was very confident and happy in being an outlier and, you know, each their
scathing
own.
Scathing, you were.
Yeah,
scathing.
Wasn't the right film for me. But for this, I'm definitely very persuadable with my thoughts and opinion here, because I think that to truly kind of understand and evaluate this film, you need a certain level of experience and expertise and knowledge and familiarity with the Western genre, and I lack that. For the second week in a row, Marvel sort of superhero films and now Westerns were kind of floating around in my nether regions. There's an image for you. With genres that are just not that knowledgeable about. And I think my understanding of this film, the reason it is so, apart from the acting, apart from the cinematography and all the other ingredients of the film, is it kind of subverts the Western genre a little bit. And really that's the kind of the Western genre that Clint Eastwood has helped to establish in people's minds as well. You know, as Joe alluded to earlier, he's got this kind of rich history. People want to go and see a Clint Eastwood Western, and actually part of the power of this film is that he subverts that. But if you don't fully kind of understand that world, then perhaps some of that went over my head a little bit, I think. And you can't deny it's beautifully filmed and beautifully framed. Clint Eastwood is an engaging screen presence. But for me, where I felt less enthusiastic than you two is, if you take away those beautiful shots of the American prairie land and desert and countryside, and you take away those kind of lingering shots of Eastwood looking moodily into the middle distance, then actually, is the story big enough to support the film? Because I wouldn't describe it as being epic in its scope and its scale. It's quite a personal study, I think, of small town violence and redemption amongst these characters. But actually, I think I was expecting something more, perhaps because I'm not that familiar. So things like Dances with Wolves or Last of the Mohicans that are these broad and majestic, sweeping films. This, for me, felt a little bit more parochial. And yeah, so for me, whilst being very open-minded and recognising I could well be wrong in several areas, for me it's a 7 out of 10, this film.
Okay. Cool. Despite being a Kevin Costner fan, by the way, Dances with Wolves, I just can't watch. It's just...
I like Dances with Wolves.
I even like Waterworld. I'd rather
over
watch,
Dances with Wolves?
I'd rather watch Waterworld than Dances with Wolves. I'd rather watch The Postman over Dances with Wolves.
God.
Wow, that is...
that's dedication.
If that's true, then I can't understand how you scored this film, a 9.
Well, I can't understand anyone that's... Dances with Wolves just... Oh, it drones on and on and on on. It doesn't... No, let's not go there. Don't pick Dance... Please don't pick Dance... there's two films now that you can threaten me with. Dance with Wolves and the aforementioned... Many aforementioned Forrest Gump.
Are you going to pull a veto if either of those two come up?
I can't pull veto. I don't. There's no censorship on this podcast. No, there's no...
Good for you. You're a better man than I am.
Yeah. Yeah, because Joe would go, what? Do that. By the way, if you did have vetoes, if I did introduce him, all three of you would veto my next choice.
Oh, no.
Oh, but wait a minute. Wait. It's not as bad as you think. So, yeah.
It's not as bad as you think. That'll draw the listeners in, won't it? We should make that the strap line for the, for the next
by the way, podcast. It'll draw the listeners in. Okay. My choice will draw the listeners in like bees mate honey. Bees don't gravitate towards honey, do they?
Flies around shit? Is that what you're
saying? I was trying to stay away from that one, but it's fine. I mean, bees to pollen? Flock into bees like... Anyway, if you record it, they will come. The idea. No, like right. Field of Dreams. Oh, listen, you filthy mind, you two. Right, we're going to go into roll call. We're going to go straight in, right? Because it's going to be big. Strap yourselves in, everyone. It's going to be epic because we've got Oscar Bantz mixing in with roll call. It's going to be amazing. I hope that's the clip that they do for the Opus clip with the short YouTube short. Anyway, here we go. Here's roll call.
Roll call.
Well, we got to start with Clint Eastwood, haven't we? Yeah, I mean, Joe, you've made a very good introduction about obviously the Western idea. And I don't want to get off that just yet, but I do want to talk about some of the other films that he made in the sort of 70s and 80s. I mean, you've got Kelly's Heroes, you've got Where Eagles Dare. I have to get it in. Broadsword Calling Danny Boy.
Was that big over there?
Oh, massive over here.
Really?
There. Richard Burton. I mean, Clint Eastwood he's all right, I suppose, he'd be in there. Richard Burton was the draw.
No, I love that film. I didn't know many people that watched it, but
I think I can spoil it by saying Richard Burton is the... Oh, no, maybe I won't. Maybe you should watch it. But yeah, Play Misty for Me, precursor to Fatal Attraction. Obviously, Dirty Harry, which you talked about. Escape from Alcatraz. I won't go to all of them, by the way, because I'll let you do some of them yourself. But just Every Which Way But Loose.
Yeah.
Every Which Way You Can. Love them. Those were my dad, genuinely, I think, apart from Monty Python, my dad's favourite films. And lastly, and I'll take you all the way up to 1982 with playing Mitchell Gant in Firefox. I love that film. It's such a guilty pleasure. But my goodness, I would watch Firefox every day, all day, every day. We'll get bored.
All the way up to 1982, like that's somehow recent or current, yeah?
No, there's some after that. I mean, go on.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot after that.
Yeah, there you go, see?
Did you mention The Outlaw Josie Wales whilst I was quickly checking something?
No, it was on my list, but I missed it out. So yes.
Well, if we're talking about epic westerns, Joe, seeing as you're probably on firmest grounds,
yeah. Okay.
when it comes to Clint Eastwood, what's your view of that film? Are you familiar with that one?
I'm not a huge fan of it, to be honest with you. That and what was the other one that he did around that time? Oh, Pale Rider, I like. That was, wasn't that in the 80s, Pale Rider?
Oh, sorry, yeah, it was, yeah,
84. It was Outlaw, High Plains Drifter.
Right.
And, he's more... If you guys haven't seen the Dallas trilogy, you need to see it because that's when Clint Eastwood is on the top of his game, as far as I'm concerned, as a as a Western hero. But yeah, I never really fell in love with any of his Westerns other than Unforgiven, just because it, for me, it kind of was the bookend for his career, I felt too. And it ended on a nice bookend. I mean, he went on to do other movies, but I think that he kind of stopped his Westerns, which was a good idea. What else did he did?
Heartbreak Ridge.
Heartbreak Ridge.
Oh, what a film.
What was the one where he played the CIA agent?
The Secret Service agent in The Line of Fire.
Yeah, Secret Service agent. Yeah. Actually, I knew a guy in the Secret Service, and he told me at the time that that crew and Clint Eastwood consulted with them, and that they were only allowed to give them so much information. He wouldn't give me information, you know, like he couldn't say what kind of guns they used, you know, like how they would do their techniques and all that. But they said it was fairly accurate.
Yeah. I'm going to have to mention it. I'm sorry, but only because I kind of liked it when it came out. The Rookie with Charlie Sheen, where he's good. Million Dollar Baby, The Mule, Gran Torino. So The Mule, if you haven't
Gran Torino was good.
The Mule was very, very good. Either of you seen that one?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, he is exceptional in it. He's 93.
Yeah, he doesn't, you know, well, he's old, but...
He's not the oldest on Roll Call.
Oh, I saw a picture of Gene Hackman recently. I should have sent it to you guys.
No, I saw it, and there were people posting on Twitter going, oh, how sad that, you know, linking to the article where the picture was on it. How sad that people feel the need to post a picture of, you know, a man clearly in, you know, medical need. I'm like, dude, you just posted the photo. You just shared it. So, you know, I need to amend it.
It's interesting, unless I missed it, that neither of you have mentioned those two films that he did in the early noughties. Letters from Iwo Jima, Flags of Our Fathers, that kind of back-to-back film that he did, one from the Japanese perspective, one for the Americans on...
Again,
I don't know how much of a fan I am of war film genre, but they are good. But my observation on Eastwood, when you look at his career and his filmography, is he must be able to have like trodden the truest path in Hollywood of any kind of star director that I can think of, with the exception of something like maybe The Rookie or In the Line of Fire, and they're not kind of out and out commercial films. He's really kind of trodden his personal path, exploring, you know, and he's had the luxury or the choice to end, you know, the Western genre, as Joe says, in the early 90s, to explore kind of American-Japanese perspective from World War II, to kind of make films that are really personal and meaningful to him. And he's had commercial success along the way, and he's had some industry recognition. You know, I think as a brand, he's well-known and well-established. But yeah, how many other people can say that they've been able to do that? Not many, I'd wager. You know, obviously someone like Scorsese as a director, perhaps, but... I mean, like a combination of actor director
and create iconic characters. I mean, you know, I didn't realize he started out as a director so early. You know, he directed Play Misty for Me, and you're like
1971. Oh.
Incredible. And it just shows that he can make those sort of pop bubblegum films, as I call them, like Firefox, and then equally he can make the really, really hard-hitting, just as a director.
My favourite, though, you know, lots of good contenders, lots of interesting films, stuff you could sit down, if you're in the right mood, I would say, for a Clint Eastwood film. It's not something that's immediately accessible, you've kind of got to be in the mood for it, I think, but for me, his best film bar none is Dirty Harry. I absolutely love that. That's, iconic and popular culture, some of the lines from that is a hell of a film.
And it's the best of the series as well.
Yeah, and if we ever do go back into the 70s, you know, if we go back that far, abandon our listenership altogether, then that's definitely going to be one of my film choices there. So,
okay. Well, from Clint Eastwood then to Gene Hackman. Anyone want to take this one before I do have the list of films, and I've got some personal favourites. I know, Joe, what you're going to start with, and you might as well start with
Might as well. Superman, the movie, and the sequels, he was in most of them. But I think he's mostly remembered for The French Connection.
Yeah, definitely.
that another film from 1971 alongside Dirty Harry's The French Connection. And if any of our listeners, who I know are connoisseurs, so I'm sure this doesn't apply, but if anybody's not seen The French Connection and French Connection 2, one of those examples where the sequel is excellent as well, check it out. That is a hell of a film, or a couple of films.
Yeah. I was telling Charlie not too long ago, well, Disney bought Fox and they own the rights to The French Connection, and they started editing the film because they use the N-word, or Gene Hackman does at one point. And not only did they remove it from any discs that you buy, but they went into any digital versions and they switched out versions. So if you own The French Connection and you bought it like 10 years ago, you have a different one in there now, which is
chilling,
sad.
It is. I mean, fine. If you must put your little silly, you know, warnings at the start of these films, but keep them exactly the way that they are every single time. Gene Hackman, then. Dom.
Come on, go. Well, some slight French Connection, but another one without trying to sound like too much of a film buff, but, you know, really is excellent cinema, as opposed to a movie, I suppose, would be The Conversation. So that's all about surveillance, voyeurism, you know, very kind of Hitchcockian film. That's well worth checking out. But if you compare and contrast Hackman's career with Eastwood's, they've both been highly successful, highly decorated, major film stars. But whereas, as I mentioned, Eastwood has trodden his own path, kind of a very much personal project, Hackman's not afraid to kind of get his hands a little bit more dirty with some of the film. But discerning choices as well. I've not got his complete filmography in front of me, but, you know, doesn't put too many steps wrong, I don't think. And the films that he is in, like the more popular ones, Crimson Tide, Enemy of the State, Behind Enemy Lines, and so on, they all stand up, I think. Those are all decent films, you know, in the case of Crimson Tide, absolutely brilliant film as well. So, you know, hats off to either Gene Hackman or his agents anyway, because he's made some shrewd choices, and I think he's more well-rounded, perhaps. You know, has a broader filmography than Eastwood does, would be my
opinion. He does. And you're right about him taking risks, because if you look between 94 and 97, let's go 94, 96, Wyatt Earp, so he plays Wyatt Earp's dad in that, and he's very good. The Quick and the Dead, yes, all right, it's got Sharon Stone, DiCaprio, and it's a Western, and yes, it's a bit like a companion piece to this. If you want something, some fluff to attach to it, fine. Crimson Tide, Get Shorty, where he plays the film producer and like quite meek and stuff and wants to be like John Travolta and wants to be quite hard. But then from nowhere, he's in The Birdcage. Have either of you seen The Birdcage?
Yeah.
Once a long time ago, yeah.
I mean, the ending of that, you're just like, Gene Hackman, fair play to you, mate. You know, you are taking roles, and, you know, the captain of the USS Alabama from Crimson Tide would look at him in that and go, "What the hell are you doing, son?" I, when we go back, like, all the way back with Gene Hackman, you've got Bonnie and Clyde, The Poseidon Adventure, Young Frankenstein, Reds, Kevin Costner again, unfortunately. No Way Out, Mississippi Burning, Class Action, The Firm, Runaway Jury, was one of the last films he made, and then he just didn't act. He just didn't make any films after that. And I think, obviously, as we pointed out, that his ill health, he is not in good shape at the moment. But 94, and he's still going. I think he's great.
My favorite movie by him is Hoosiers. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
See, I saw that, but I've never seen it, and I don't know what it relates to.
Is it about basketball or something?
Yeah, he plays a high school basketball coach, and he has a past. Like I think he hit a kid in his previous job, and he's trying to redeem himself to bringing these guys into national champions. It's a really, really good movie, and who's that guy that's in it? He was an Easy Rider.
Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper.
There you go, Dennis Hopper. He's in it too. Yeah, I would really suggest you check that out. It's a very well-made movie.
And if I can't let Gene Hackman pass without mentioning Royal Tenenbaums. I know Wes Anderson's not everyone's cup of tea, and but I really like him, and that for me is my favourite one of his movies, I think. And he's Gene Hackman is excellent in that film.
Never seen it, so I need to go see it. Right, okay, yeah, I will check that out.
I like Wes Anderson movies.
I can't say I've really seen a lot. Yeah. Just before we get to Morgan Freeman, we need to do Richard Harris. You think he's done? I mean, he has. I mean, you know, classical actor, brilliant in this. You know, The Guns of Navarone. Sorry, I've got to mention this, but in 4 weeks' time, I'll be sitting on a beach earning 20%. No, I won't be earning 20%. I'll be, well, I don't know what my ISA earns me, but it's not 20%. But I will be in Rhodes in Anthony Quinn Bay, where they filmed The Guns of Navarone. That's where I'll be. Oof.
So I'm going to ask you really, really quick, Charlie. I think you got to pull your microphone closer.
Oh, okay. That better?
Yeah.
All right, okay. So, yes, I will be where they filmed Guns of Navarone, which Richard Harris was in. Here is a Telemark Camelot, where he played King Arthur, Man Called Horse. The Underrated, and again, it's a very, very strange film and was made, I think, in direct because Jaws was successful, but Orca.
Yeah.
70% of it is rubbish, and it's just, but there's a performance in there waiting to, you know, there's a good film in there somewhere. Guilty pleasure again.
Tarzan,
Wild Geese. Then he pops up again in Patriot Games, the Tom Clancy one with Harrison Ford, and he's dreadful in it. And then pops up as Marcus Aurelius in Gladiator.
Mm.
And then Joe, or Dom. In fact, no, I keep pointing, I keep asking Joe, Dom, take it away. What is he, most people will remember him for?
Well, most of our younger listeners will know him as Dumbledore, weren't they, in Harry Potter. So he was into, how many was he in the first?
Two.
Oh, yeah, that's right. God bless his soul.
The best Dumbledore.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. Absolutely. Michael Gambon. Really?
Again, Gambon's a good actor, but he's no Dumbledore.
So I can't let us pass Richard Harris without mentioning even... listeners, stay with us, but I'm going to mention a film from 1962, Marlon Brando, Mutiny on the Bounty. That is a brilliant film. I love naval films. They're really, really good. And that is a hell of a film and brilliant performance. I mean, that is, for me, just an underrated gem from Brando's career. But yeah, Richard Harris plays an important part in that film too, so check that out, listeners.
I was going to mention that one too.
People consuming us on YouTube, of course. Hello to all our fans out there.
Love you all. Speaking of the love, let's keep it going. Morgan Freeman then. What would we say? I'm looking at the list of films and I can't decide which his breakout film was. So can someone help me?
Driving Miss Daisy.
Would you?
You're probably right there. Yeah, I would say. I would say my favorite role movie that he's in is Glory. I love that movie, Glory.
Which was the year after. Yeah. You got Drive It. You got Lean on Me, where he plays a principal that's hard nosed principal and stuff. I genuinely like that one. It was a straight to video one over here. Driving Miss Daisy, Glory, but then. Isn't the Shawshank Redemption where everyone, if you ask people on the street, 90% of them would say Shawshank Redemption. Surely.
Yeah, but his breakthrough movie, Driving Miss Daisy, the one that cemented his fame, would be Shawshank Redemption, I think. So that's the difference. You ask 100 people to name one of his films, and I'm sure that Shawshank Redemption would be top of the list, probably.
However, if one of those people was Joe, he would mention them in a certain trilogy. Maybe, would you?
Wait, him in a certain trilogy?
Yeah.
I can't think of it.
Weapons designer?
Oh, Dark Knight. I forgot about that.
Yeah, Lucius Fox. He's in all three. Yeah. I know I'm skipping ahead, because obviously after Shawshank Redemption, then Stratospheric. And then I think he just... very, very quickly attains elite mythical status. And everyone's like, Morgan Freeman's like the best thing in the world. I'm like, I know he's done some films. And yes, he's done some films that you like, but you've now elevated him into this. Oh, it's got Morgan Freeman. It's got the gravitas. It's got everything. And I'm like, maybe it's deserved. Don't know. He was in Amistad, Steven Spielberg's Amistad. Played the president in Deep Impact. Where do you stand on Deep Impact versus Armageddon, which is the better film for you? Both came out at the same time. Both of them were asteroids hitting the Earth.
Wasn't Pierce Brosnan in Deep Impact?
The note of contempt in Joe's voice.
I know. Anything with Pierce Brosnan in, he's just like, seriously. You've got to get over your Pierce Brosnan thing. You really do. I can't remember who he was.
He was in one of those movies. It could have been about a volcano. I don't remember, but if he's in a movie, I don't like him.
Oh, sorry. Wait a minute. Dante's Peak.
Or maybe that was it. He's in Dante's Peak.
I was thinking of picking Dante's Peak, but I've taken it off. I have genuinely taken it off.
Jesus.
Forrest Gump is back on the list. Yeah, my God. Right. So Morgan Freeman reminds me of Clint Eastwood as an actor, though, in some ways, in that Eastwood has this presence that we talked about. He's brooding, staring into the mid-distance, his kind of, you know, grim set jaw that he brings to things. He's, you know, quite a physical actor in that sense. Doesn't have to say a lot to convey a lot. But Morgan Freeman is similar, I think, physically, but it's his voice as well. It's so kind of melodic and sonorous. You know, I think he gets and I mean this is a compliment, not criticism, but I think he gets away with a lot just by being himself and speaking and acting there. Well, all these actors that we've talked about so far are, maybe a slight exception for Richard Harris, an example of less is more, you know, genuine acting. And that's, you know, one of the key strengths of this film that we'll discuss and review shortly is the performances from the lead actors. But yeah, Freeman reminds me of Clint Eastwood in that way.
Definitely.
Yeah, he's got an amazing speaking voice. He's done several documentaries. He used to narrate the Hall of Presidents at Disney World, and then they redid it and they have Angela Bassett doing it now. And so many people miss Morgan Freeman's version because he just has an amazing voice.
Like silk, isn't it? It's gravitas and silk. It's just great.
Gravitas and silk. That should be the name of our business.
That's our new band.
Yeah, gravitas and silk. How have we got this far into discussion about him? We're not mentioning Seven.
We were about to, but yeah, let's mention Seven.
Yeah, okay. Seven, very good film, folks. Yeah.
Yeah, very good film. Great twist in the end. He's also a Million Dollar Baby. He plays
That's
God.
What you come here for. It's our film criticism. Seven gets one line. Very good film. It is a very good film.
You've got to move things along. Okay. Plays God in Bruce Almighty and the Heaven Almighty, which is a dreadful sequel. Bruce Almighty's all right. Pretty good. Who else is going to play God? Million Dollar Baby, Batman Begins, Gone Baby Gone, Wanted. He played Nelson Mandela in Invictus. He was also in Red. I can't even bring myself to say they're so bad that they're good. The Olympus Has Fallen trilogies. He's dreadful. He ends up being the president. Pops up in Ted 2 as himself. And Now You See Me. And there's Now You See Me, Now You See Me 2. When I looked in at what he was doing, oh, he's making Now You See Me 3. The third film nobody wanted the second film, but they still made it. So anyway, there we are.
Charlie, two technical matters. A, you need to move your mic again, but B, let's have a time check, so I want to make sure we're keeping this nice and punchy under an hour like our listeners have requested.
22 minutes
in. Yeah,
I have almost a half hour.
No, okay, all right, okay. But I've got 22 minutes, but still, okay. Yeah, no problem. Look, sorry to all the others. If you were listening and going, oh, I can't wait, my turn on roll call. Sorry, that's it. We're just covering the four because now we're getting into the film.
But are we getting into the film or are we doing Unforgiven at the 65th Academy Awards?
Yeah, Oscar Bance.
Well, I'll just pause here for you to cue in the special little music that you've had commissioned for me. So hang on a second.
Oscar Bance.
Right, so yeah, it was nominated for 9 Oscars at the 65th Academy Awards and won 4 of them, which, you know, is an okay return. I prefer it when films don't just sweep the board like Oppenheimer did this time round. So, crucially, it won Best Picture, beating The Crying Game, A Few Good Men, Howard's End, and Scent of a Woman. So that's a pretty strong year, I think, all in all, and I think that's a deserved victory. Howard's End, I do love that film, but can't really claim its best picture material. And this is where Eastwood won his Oscar for Best Director as well, so beat Neil Jordan for The Crying Game, James Ivory for Howard's End, Robert Altman for The Player, and Martin Brest for Scent of a Woman. Robert Altman for The Player, that's a tough one. Yeah, absolutely.
That's Gene a good film.
Gene Hackman won for Best Supporting Actor, beating contenders from The Crying Game, Jack Nicholson from A Few Good Men. That must have been a tight one. Al Pacino for Glengarry Glen Ross, and David Palmer for Mr. Saturday Night. And it also won in a technical category for Best Film Editing. It lost for cinematography, slightly surprisingly, I thought, because it is a beautifully cinematic film, but lost to A River Runs Through It. Lost a couple of the technical Oscars that I won't go into. But the one which is the biggest shock / disgrace of all was Eastwood did not win for Best Actor, although despite being nominated. So other nominees who failed to win were Robert Downey Jr. for Chaplin, Stephen Reeve for The Crying Game, and Denzel Washington for Malcolm X. But the person who walked away with the
I know Academy who Award, it was, yeah.
Yeah. What a punch in the happy sack this is. Al Pacino for Scent of a Woman. Wow.
You have mentioned this on previous times, and I know the disdain you have for this. But two things I've got to say in his defense. One, this is the Academy playing, why haven't we given him an award, so yeah, we need to give him an award, and now's the time we're going to do it. And secondly, you make Scent of a Woman out to be one of the worst, for you know, the ripping contempt when you say it. It's not bad. It's not a bad film. It's got a great ending in the, you know, with the Charlie facing the fire at the school disciplinary. It's all right. What were you?
Well, I know you're a fan of it, and you're downplaying there. It's not a bad film. This is a film that you enjoy. So you just have to agree to disagree here. But I just think this is where it's not so much that Pacino trips into pastiche here. He's like embraces it, stuffs it down his pants, makes love to it, and then it becomes his persona. So you know, I'm not sure exactly when Robert De Niro jumped the shark, but he clearly did.
Rocky and Bullwinkle.
It's when he lost all his money in that Madoff pyramid scheme thing, wasn't it? And had to just take any work going. But Pacino here, honestly, it's beyond caricature. Yeah, so he's just, for me, I lost all respect for him as an actor. You know, got great history, great back catalogue, but this was the tipping point for me. And for him to be, I know how the Academy works. They do have to give out we haven't given it to Scorsese yet. What can we give it to him for? But yeah, this was robbery. And Eastwood, if that's probably put any of those ahead of Pacino for that. Yeah, so moment for me.
What the Oscars should do is put all of the films that didn't win and put them into categories, and just have like an FA Cup draw and put five against, and then let the public decide.
Yeah. Democracy doesn't work, my friend. No, we're better off these shadowy, smoky deals being done in back rooms, I think.
Sorry, Joe.
I was just going to say, I agree with you. I think that it was for sentimental reasons why they gave it to him. This was like, basically trying to celebrate his career as a movie actor. It wasn't his best performance. And I have to say, I'm going to say that for Clint Eastwood winning Best Director, too. I don't think that this was his best directed movie. But I think that, again, this was something that the Academy likes to do. They like to reward somebody that's been nominated several times and give them an Oscar.
We didn't give it you for The Godfather, even though we should have done, because I don't know if your Oscar bounce extends to 1973, but yeah, pretty much. I don't know who else. I don't know who he was up against, but I refuse to believe there was anyone better than him.
Well, we can never review The Godfather, even if you do go back to the 70s, can we? Because what is there to say apart from classic? Short pod, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's good. 10 out of 10, everyone. See you later. See you next week.
Who would pay to watch the three of us standing around circle jerking over The Godfather, eh? We'd have to... we'd be testing our audience's...
We'd have Amanda in there, but I mean, that paints a happy picture, doesn't it? So yeah,
we can move to OnlyFans rather than giving it away for free on YouTube, eh?
Yes. And on that note, let's get to the film then. I know this is the most violent, anti-violence film that I've seen.
You're going to have to explain that, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, because it's all about somebody who used to, well, look at his past. His past, he killed women and children by his own admission. You've got this new up-and-coming guy that the, what's he called? The something kid? I can't remember his name. The kid
that's trying to
recruit him. Let's call him Kid. Who wants to be, apparently, he's killed 5 people. And you've got this undertone of, violence is bad, and I want to put it to one side, and I don't want to do it. And you actually see the ramifications when the kid shoots somebody for the first time, and he can't cope with it, and it's like, I can't do this anymore. That's it. He wanted to be the new Clint Eastwood, the new William Money, but couldn't do it.
So we're starting at the end, are we, with our review?
No, but I mean, I'm just, you asked me the reason why. It's just kind of like, Amy, let's start at the beginning. Amy passed, and I said, oh, I'm forgiven. And I forgot what happens at the start. And I said, oh, I'm forgiven. Yeah, I think there's a few bad bits, but I think there's more towards the end. I forgot about the scene at the start.
Before we get onto that scene that you're referring to,
Else do you want me to start? We're starting at the start.
Scene, I want to start at the start, as in literally the first shot of the movie, which is this gorgeous, sumptuous, silhouetted Clint Eastwood burying his wife at the base of this tree and on their land, and the sun is setting behind them, and it's just absolutely gorgeously framed, and just straight into this world, and spoiler alert, the film ends on the equivalent shot after he's abandoned the homestead, and that for me is the theme that returns all the way through the film, which is that just the beautiful use of the landscape. But there is a slight part of me that wonders how hard it is to actually achieve that, because it is so glorious, the prairie, the desert land out there, these wild wildernesses which clearly still exist today, hence why it's filmed and recreated so lovingly. But I just think, shout out for that opening shot, it's gorgeous. And now we can talk about the whole beat.
Well, I was going to say the music being played too, just the guitar gently being played.
Evocative, yeah.
And I'm kind of, I hate to do this, but I'm going to go a little bit all over the place, and this is why I like it, is that I think it's fascinating that there's these themes, like where you see Gene Hackman's character. Now, again, he's not the best shootist or a gunslinger or anything like that, and neither is Clint Eastwood, but what they do is they have confidence, and that they can emote fear, and that's why they've always been successful. And like, when you hear the legend of what Will Money had done in the past, he doesn't want to talk about it. Like, he regrets the things that he did, where the kid is the opposite. He makes up this whole story about how he killed all these men and that he's a terrible, bandit and all that. And I just think that contrast is very interesting, especially towards the end, which, again, I won't get towards the very end, where we do see the characters change and emerge. I like that those themes that we see that, because I think this was like the first time that I watched it where I noticed that it's mostly about confidence, and not about skill in this movie. And again, like I said, you see that through Gene Hackman's character and through Clint Eastwood's character. It's like, who is able to have, emote the most fear onto somebody. And especially in that last scene, but again, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So shall we talk about the scene? Sorry, Chuck, I feel I did cut you off.
Yeah,
about the incident in the
brutal. I mean, I forgot how brutal that is. And Amy was just kind of like walking back into the room, and I went, no, just a minute, I'll pause it, because I think she caught a bit of it. And I'm like, God, it's unrelenting, and it just doesn't stop. When you think it's going to stop, carries on, you're like, oh my goodness. I mean, from the point, what were they expecting? What justice were they expecting? At the end of the day, they wanted, the guys to be hanged, and he gets a bullwhip out and then goes, wait a minute, no, we can do a horse trade here, we can do a, this sort of thing. And you're kind of like, what a scene setup. Of you're trying to make Gene Hackman out to be somebody who's not easily bought off, but his morals are, actually, I was going to do this, but now I'm going to do this. I think it's going to be a fitting punishment for them. And that's chilling in itself, because you kind of like, I just think every time a character is introduced, I mean, I know I'm going to fast forward a little bit, when English Bob, you first meet him on the train, characters are introduced so well that you almost like you don't need to know their backstory. You're making it up in your own head. So yeah, for me, I think this is a belting stand.
Well, I also think too, I think it's interesting too, because you don't know who to believe if you're watching this for the first time. Do you believe English Bob? Do you believe Gene Hackman's character? Was it Little Bill? Or do you believe, you know, what they said about Will Money? Or do you believe the kid and all that? Like, somebody is going to be caught out that they're not the person that they perceive to be, or that they're telling tall tales about their history. And it's just, I think it's fascinating that the one that's the most truthful says the least about his past.
Yeah, definitely.
I think what I enjoyed about the start of this film, I was concerned, because, you know, not being a big fan of Westerns generally, that the film would drag sometimes. I can find them a bit slow paced. But within the first 15 minutes of this film, the mutilation has happened, the punishment has been administered, the bounty hunter has been sourced, and then there's the kind of character development of Clint Eastwood and the gang of prostitutes that operate in the brothel as well. So it lingers, it takes its time in certain respects, you know, the framing and the cinematography, but actually the plot does develop and crack along, and I thought that was good. As somebody who's not a huge fan of these things, it was decent pace to the start of the film.
Can I get my minor annoyances out?
Sure.
Minor. The issue of the bounty. See, they raised $1,000 in order to do that. I don't understand two things. Why does every bounty hunter or assassin have to make themselves so well known when they come into town, when they don't know what the setup is there? They don't know that Little Bill's kind of like in on it, and is kind of like, I've administered my punishment. There's no further punishment needed. You're almost taking the high ground on it. Why would you walk into town, give up your gun? Well, sorry, not give up your gun. But why would you walk into town and allow that to happen? Surely you go, wait a minute, so these are the ladies of the night in the billiard house. Why don't you go around to the billiard house and just go, yeah. Why do you make yourself so blatant? And the second minor annoyance I've got to say is, when they're hiding out, they hide out in the hut in view of the town. That was just an annoyance to me, because it's kind of like, does everyone hide there when they're trying to, you know, Clint Eastwood had 3-4 days of recuperation there without anybody looking for him, despite the fact that when he goes into town at the end, they're all planning on where he's going to be. Oh, it turns out he was in the hut for 4 days. But nobody went and had a look. Minor annoyances. But anyway, yeah. The English Bob scene, we're moving it along then. What do we think of him as a character?
Well, the introduction on the train, when there's a little bit of British US beef going on. I don't know. I can feel my hackles rising a little bit. I can feel feel myself rooting for the Union Jack flying there. The talk of royalty, the Queen brought a tear to my eye.
Yeah.
About you, Joe. How did you feel about your presidents being disrespected in such a brazen way?
No, he was just egging them on. And again, he knew that he was going to beat them in confidence, because he had there was a legend of English Bob, and probably a lot of people knew about it, and once word got around on the train who he was, he knew that they were going to back down, and that's exactly what they did. But again, his problem is that he met up with someone that did know who English Bob was, and I hope I'm not getting too far ahead of myself or ourselves, but I just every time I watch it, I just find some things a little more fascinating. But I do agree with you, Don and Charlie, it's not perfect. It does have flaws in the movie, but it's still, for me, it's an enjoyable movie. Like, if Clint Eastwood's character was a different character, like where we already knew, like say they would have started the movie with a flashback and we had seen him murdering people with Morgan Freeman's character. And they'd probably do something like that today, you know. It just would have ruined the movie because it's still a mystery. We don't know, like, how could a man like this who has two kids and he quotes the Bible and he prays for his dead wife. It's like, how could he be as bad as the rumors say he was? And I guess that's why I like the character, because he met somebody that we never seen really, that he fell in love with, that changed his life, that he decided to give up everything, raise a family, become a farmer. And then when she died, he still stayed to his commitment, where he refused to drink anymore, he refused to swear or cuss or become a bandit, because she did something to him that changed him forever.
I think that's interesting, but isn't there also an element of the fact that actually he was a really successful mean son of a bitch before he was redeemed, and then he married and had children, raised pigs on a farm, as you say, but his wife died young, tragically. His pigs were riddled with swine fever. He was scratching out a living in this kind of dusty remote farmstead, if you can call it that. And actually, it's only, again, spoiler alert, getting towards the end of the film, when he gets back on the hard stuff and goes on a kill spree, that he's kind of this fully realized man again in this figure. So I just wonder if there's a deliberate attempt there to slightly play with us. You know, when is he happiest? When is he most successful? And I do agree, his character development is great, and it's thank goodness they didn't go into flashback territory. But yeah, as you say, Joe, the bit when he was kind of redeemed, he was very unsuccessful as well.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of, sorry, Charlie, you go.
No, go.
No, I think it's like, again, that tale, like with the scorpion and the frog, where I won't get into it, but it's, you are what you are, you know, and he was meant to be a mean son of a bitch bastard, you know, even though like he tried to change himself, it was still in him. And that's why he was successful at the end of doing what he did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. When I think the beating of the English, when English Bob gets beaten, is quite brutal. However, it leads into the scene, because English Bob has his biographer with him, which is writing the story incorrectly. We don't know if it's incorrect, because obviously we only have English Bob's story and we have Gene Hackman's that I was there. I'm going to have to say my favourite scene was in the jail cell, where English Bob is in the cell, biographer's outside, you know, just chatting. I mean, Gene Hackman could read the phone book. You know, we talk about Pacino having a character after sending a woman, which is hoo-ah, and it's all about that. Gene Hackman doesn't have one, but when he gets mad, he gets really mad, and you know, he gets really, you know, really sort of scary, and he's very effective at that. But the bit where he has the gun and gives the gun over, I'm just like, we are in again. I hasten to keep using the same word. We're in masterclass territory. We are in, you know, the meeting of minds. I just think that was a brilliant scene for me. I think it's my favourite.
I think it's probably the scene that won in the Oscar, I'd agree. And I do think it's a strong scene, but I found a little bit the English Bob and certainly his biographer a bit superfluous. They're kind of, they don't actually interact with the main protagonists at all in the film, do they? They're kind of like almost like a subplot.
No.
And I find parts of it a bit repetitive, you know, the way that they come into town full of confidence, get disarmed. You know, Hackman establishes his kind of psycho credentials, and you know, obviously one case is they leave town in shame and disgrace. The other one, there's some, you know, some violence at the end of it. But I found it a bit repetitive, and could have, you know, a bit of tighter editing would have worked there, I think.
And just having to move things along from a point of view of Clint Eastwood going, you know, the relationship he has with Morgan Freeman, I think is a strong relationship. Because it's almost like, yeah, we're back again. We're going to go and do this we need to go and do this. You know, you need money, I need money, this is what we need to go and do. When they go into town, make the same mistake, and go straight at there, and obviously gets a whooping from Gene Hackman. I found that particularly, I know it had to happen, but it was kind of like unnecessary. Not unnecessary, but I didn't like it.
See, I'm going to disagree with both of you. I hate to do this, but I'm going to have to go back to what you just said, Dom. You know, with the English Bob scene, he was needed. The only reason why that character was put in there was so that we could see just how fearless little Bill was. It had to build his character up because, you know, Bob could have shot him, but he had no fear. He had no fear of death. And even at the end, he has no fear of death. I mean, he's got a gun pointed at him. He's like, all right, as soon as he shoots me, he goes, you make sure you just unload on him. And, you know, the scene you're talking about with Clint Eastwood, again, he still holds on to his vow that he made to his wife. And he refuses to fight. You know, he refuses to drink, even though he probably knows that if he had to, he could kill everybody in that bar. So I think that's both fantastic scenes. And if we would have seen more of English Bob and that they would have teamed up with Clint Eastwood's crew, that kind of would have ruined the film. And they have done that in previous movies. But I thought that that made it special because I knew that that's what they were trying to do, is they wanted to define what the character of Little Bill was. He kicks English Bob's ass and then he leaves. You know, and then again, it puts the fear in the town of what Little Bill is actually like, and also any other type of assassins that come after those cowboys, apparently.
Well, okay. Well, can we talk about the kind of culmination of the film then? So, and you check me if I'm getting too far ahead here, Charlie, but you talked about some of your minor annoyances in the film. I think one of the things I would call out would be the fact that, you know, there is this... He discovers Morgan Freeman's being killed. He finally succumbs to the whiskey. He gets his kind of rage and his fury on. And the way that he kind of distributes his vengeance and his justice is just by walking straight into the bar. So he just, you know, he literally walks through the front door and he's got a gun and you know, nobody else is drawn on him. And that's where he starts to process of shooting, and he's a crack shot, everybody else is a poor shot. And for me, it just felt a little bit vaguely like, I don't know, Star Wars or something, where if only somebody could shoot straight, the whole film would end in a very different different manner. And I just thought the way that he kind of went about it, just literally walking through the front door or the whatever they call those salon doors, was slightly underwhelming.
Oh, okay. I guess that's what it in a different way is. I'm supremely confident I can take out everybody in this room, so I'm just going to walk through the door. And the fact that he walks into the conversation where, well, I think he's gone north, and I think we need to head north tomorrow, you know, but for tonight we drink. And he's just like standing there with his gun raised, and it's like, you know that retribution's coming. Gene Hackman at that point knows, shit, time's up.
One thing being taken by surprise. It's another thing just not having any guards and just stood around.
Yeah, I mean,
all right, hang on, he's here.
But he does. Who does he shoot first? Then, do you remember?
Yeah.
So he shoots the bar owner because bar owner, because he recognizes that the bar owner is a scumbag and needs to be taken out first in the hierarchy of people. This guy was the confident, the grass. That did everything. Oh, just to let you know what's happening. Boom. Take him out. The bibliographer, yeah, the biographer's not going to do anything. You know, keeps it away. You know, I'm unarmed. But, yeah. I was surprised that Gene Hackman got shot so quickly and so early in that whole scene.
I think I'm seeing something else. Like that scene where he starts drinking the whiskey and the girl is telling him what happened to Ned. That's one of my favorite scenes in movie history. I think it's an amazing scene because, again, that's the point where he breaks his vow and then he becomes who he was meant to be. And he can go into town. And yeah, you could say, well, how can he single-handedly go into a bar with just what seems like one shotgun? I think it was shotgun.
But he had the gun as well.
Yeah, he had another gun, yeah. But it just seems like, because he's not afraid of death, he's fearless. And then the whole town, before all this stuff happened, it was just a nice, cozy little town. And little Bill moved there because he wanted to live in a town where it was quiet and nothing really happened. And then all of a sudden he got thrown into all this shit with the cowboys and all that. But he did have a past where, you know, he could be a kick-ass sheriff, and he kind of proved that he was. But they, again, they were all celebrating, but they heard the story that Ned said to the town of how bad Will was. So once he came walking in and they realized who it was, they were scared shitless of him. Everybody in that room, even Bill, had a little fear in there, I think. Yeah. But he still was willing to die over, which, you know, he felt it's good versus bad. So Bill was like, all right, shoot me first. I don't care. Just make sure you kill him. But again, those other, his deputies and the people in the town, they were mostly cowards. Because like when you think, when you, if you're a bully and you have a gang of bullies, you feel protected that there's so many people. But when you come across like a really nasty force against you, that's when you're like, well, I don't want any part of this. You know, I don't want to get killed. And they were scared. They couldn't. And that was the whole thing, too, is that what little Bill was saying in the jail cell is you don't have to be the best shooter. You know, you just have to have the courage to shoot. And I think a lot of these deputies and all that, they were so scared that they were afraid to shoot, or they were nervous about shooting, where Bill Money, he didn't. Like he knew he had a job. He was drunk at that point. He was back to how he used to be. And I just think, again, that's a brilliant scene. I just love that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that takes us to the end of the film.
Yeah, but I think just acknowledge Joe's thoughts and perspective there. I think that was a very compelling picture you paint there, Joe. And definitely.
I think
Unforgiven is the sort of film that would benefit from being seen more than once. And when I do watch it again, I'll certainly have that in my mind. And pretty eloquently put there, my friend. So yeah.
Has he changed your score? Has he changed your score?
I would say I'm still at a 7, but it is a fluid 7. So I'm sticking with 7. 7 and 2 9s is not a bad outcome at all.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Well, 7 and 2 9s for Unforgiven. Unfortunately, Amanda's not here to choose the next film. So the honour goes to you, Dom, for the next film.
Yeah. And it got me thinking a little bit earlier. So I'm keeping myself on my toes here. So this wasn't on my shortlist until today. So I've just added it in now. And I think it was the mention of the film 7 earlier, which made me think of this. So the film I'm going to choose isn't 7, but it's 7 adjacent. And that is Fight Club. So our next one is just sneaking in 1999 towards the tail end. Is Fight Club, and let's see how that stands the test of time. My only caveat, though, is Amanda has to be present for that one, I think, because it is quite a film about men and their relationship with one another, and perhaps their relationship with women as well, a little bit. So, does it stand the test of time? What's the female perspective on it? I'm looking forward to doing the thing we can't talk about, which is Fight Club.
Well, it's a great choice. I haven't seen it in quite a long time.
I am so glad you picked that, Dom. It was on my list, and I was like, it's not going to make it. I have to choose 4 movies. God damn. It's like, I hope somebody picks that movie.
Is there some sort of unofficial horse trading going on behind the scenes that I don't know about?
Amanda was going to choose Trainspotting, wasn't she? Or that was on her long list as well. But came to me. I'm now seeing what I'm going to have to drop from the 3 I did have remaining. But yeah, I just feel like we've done some really interesting choices these last couple, you know, Blade and Unforgiven, kind of personal. I just think let's go for was it a blockbuster? Certainly a high-profile film, which I think has a legacy. We'll just have to see whether it's an enduring legacy or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't forget, after your choice and then Amanda's choice, we then got the viewer's choice. The listener's choice. Well, it is the viewer in this case. I can't remember if I've already said what it is. Okay, you're right. Okay, fine.
Who's the viewer? That's what I'm interested in.
Oh, it's Kush.
Kush. So we've broken our Frankie sequence then. So Kush, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Kush has nominated it, and a fine choice it is too, Kush.
Greetings, yes. Kush. Looking forward to hearing what that might be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to covering it. Right. Well, the Three Musketeers. Great. Love that podcast. I thought it was brilliant. And looking forward to the next one. So on that note, I'm going to say cheerio.
See
you. Bye-bye.
Oh, toodle pip. Sorry, I've got to say it for her. Bye.
We miss you. Cheers.